Hello, and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week on the program, we are taking a somewhat humorous but scientifically accurate look at whether a zombie apocalypse or other devastating plague could affect the Arctic. Today's show is called Can the Zombie Apocalypse Happen in the Arctic? And Other Tales of Arctic Infectious Diseases. We're featuring Michael Bruce, who is a public health physician and medical epidemiologist trained in internal and preventative medicine. He is the epidemiology team leader at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Arctic Investigations Program here in Anchorage, Alaska. This event was sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council and took place at Beartooth Theater on April 13th. Dr. Bruce does refer to a slideshow presentation on occasion. We have that file available on our website at alaskapublic.org.
Dr. Bruce has agreed to answer some questions about his life, what he does, and how he got there. And it's a really fascinating story, and so we're super excited to share that with all of you. So let's just jump right into that as we lead up to our official program start at noon. So, Dr. Bruce, you have the coolest job ever, but what the heck do you do?
I would agree with you, Lisa. I agree with you. I think I have the greatest job in the world. I mean, I'm biased, but I'm a medical epidemiologist. I don't know how many of you know what that is, but basically, I went to medical school, did training clinically to become a doctor in residency, and then I went on to learn public health and how to become a public health doctor. And public health doctors, what we tend to do is we tend to address large-scale public health issues kind of on a population level. Instead of seeing patients patient by patient, we're addressing problems regionally or globally. And I think it's just a fascinating field. So I can tell you a little bit about my career path, if that would be of value, because I know all of you now are in high school, or at least in the front rows here, and are mostly juniors and seniors, is that right? I see some heads nodding. And I'll just tell you that when I was in high school and I was a junior and a senior, I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. So you're probably ahead of me in the game. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I'd have to say that when I got up in the morning to go to high school, I didn't every morning get up and go, yay, I'm going to high school. But I would say now, as a medical epidemiologist, every morning when I get up, I'm happy to go to work. I really enjoy my job. And so, I would say to you that it's best to, at least from my perspective, keep an open mind if you're going on to college, to explore a variety of different things in college, because you're never going to get an opportunity like that again. Explore a lot of different fields. That's what I did. I started off in California at the University of California, San Diego. And I knew that in high school I liked biology and language, and so I pursued some of that in college, but I tried psychology, I tried economics, I tried anthropology, and sure enough, when I hit anthropology, that really stuck. And so I majored in anthropology, and I was dead set on being an anthropologist. I was absolutely sure I was going to be an anthropologist, I was going to teach at a university, and I was going to be going and doing field work abroad and doing anthropologic studies. And then at the end of my undergraduate career, I thought, I should maybe go check out field work. And so I went with some graduate students over to West Africa, to North Togo, to do field work in North Togo. And in North Togo, we were there for 3 months, had an amazing experience. But the two things that I learned from going to Africa and doing field work were, one, I don't want to be an anthropologist, which was after 4 years of anthropology study at undergrad. And two, that what I really wanted to do is focus on medical issues, because so many people in the villages we were working in had a lot of medical problems, and there was really no medical system to address it and deal with it. So I was an interesting phone call to my parents when I got back from Africa. Hi, Mom and Dad, thanks for paying for 4 years of college. I don't want to be an anthropologist. I majored in anthropology. So I then went on to work, and the other thing I did as an undergrad that I highly, highly recommend to you guys if you're in college is go abroad. I went and spent a year abroad in France, and it was just a life-changing experience for me. If you have the opportunity as an undergraduate to go abroad, I highly, highly recommend you do it, because even if you only go for 3 months or 6 months, I went for 12 months, but to learn about a new culture and a different country is just so valuable. It almost, to me, it's almost like a magical gift to you. You will come back to the United States and you will have insight into things that people who've never left the United States will never have. It's like a magical gift to go and live abroad. And so I highly, highly recommend you do that. But back to my story. So 4 years of anthropology degree and then no anthropology. And I decided that I'd go to medical school. So I went back and I took the courses.
Back up for a second. So are you saying that to go to med school, you can major in anything?
You can major in anything. Because all I had to do was then go and take some classes in calculus, physics, and chemistry, get those requirements done. Which, you know, it's some work, but I went back and I did those requirements. I had fulfilled some of them by in college anyway, but I had to go back and finish those up, which was a bit painful. But I did that on the side while I was working in the wine business because I lived in France, which I enjoyed.
That's new to me.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, I worked in the wine business as a wine buyer for years, but I was also preparing to go to medical school. So then I went to medical school in Boston, loved it, had a great 4 years, worked very hard, but really enjoyed it. And I only applied to medical schools that had MD and MPH programs to get a medical degree or a master's in public health because I wanted to do something related to public health. And I didn't know what. I got a great medical education in Boston, but Boston was very traditional. And I'd go to my advisors in medical school and say, I want to do something in public health and medicine, what do I do? And they'd say, go and do an internal medicine residency and become an infectious disease specialist. I said, huh, that doesn't sound very public healthy. Oh, well, you'll be able to use public health on the side. So I said, okay, and I kept asking, and I never got advice. No one told me about the CDC. I didn't know about the CDC. I didn't know about opportunities for training in public health, and there are a lot out there. The only reason I figured it out was I was doing an internal medicine residency, and one of the people who came into the residency had just trained at CDC and told me all about a wonderful program called EIS, or Epidemic Intelligence Service. This is a program for people who have PhDs, MDs, or trained as nurses, have MPHs, to go on and learn public health. That's what I did. But there are a lot of opportunities for you guys, too. You guys have opportunities as high school students. If you're interested in science and you're interested in using science to solve health problems, that's what we do as epidemiologists. If you want to go into science and use science, it's a great field to go into. And you can go to CDC. They have summer internships. They'll pay you as a high school student, as a college student, to go around with epidemiologists, see what they do, go on outbreak investigations. It's a great, great program. So I would highly recommend that to you guys. Also, if you're interested in going to medical school, they do have a program where the public health service will pay for you to go to medical school. The military services will do the same thing. They'll pay for it all, and then you'll have to go and do some service with them for a period of years. And that's actually a pretty good deal considering how expensive medical school is. So that's another option for you.
Okay, so you're saying that there's programs out there that will help pay for medical school, mm-hmm. and you did the EIS service. So is that available for undergraduate and graduate studies, or is this just for graduate studies?
I only know about the payment as one for medical school, because then you go and you work as a doctor for them afterwards, and you give them, you know, medical clinical service. So I don't know that they would pay for your undergraduate or your graduate degrees and then have you go back. There's that practical aspect. You're now trained as a doctor. You're going to be a doctor with us. So I think it's that one's just for medical school.
Okay, so you come out debt-free from medical school.
Out debt-free. Instead of myself, I came out with $125,000 of debt. So that's not very fun. But we got through it eventually. But I have been working in medical epidemiology now for 20 years. I did clinical work. I love my patients. But I've never looked back. I've just had such a fun experience doing medical epidemiology. And maybe I can tell you just a quick story that sort of can illustrate medical epidemiology in action. And I'll tell you, when I showed up at CDC as a clinician, I didn't know a darn thing about public health other than what I'd studied in, when I was doing my MPH years back in Boston. And I arrived at CDC and I got placed with the meningitis and special pathogens group. And I worked with this group and I started to look at the national data for meningitis in the United States. And if you look at meningitis, you see that there's really high rates in young children. And then there's some higher rates in older populations too. But one thing I noticed that I guess other people hadn't noticed was that there was a bump in rates of meningitis among kids your age and among kids going to college. And I said, what's this all about? And people said, oh, we don't know. I don't know what that is. We're concerned about those really young kids and the elderly people. And I kept persisting and asking, and I got to the point where I thought, you know, this is worth investigating. So I, with some other colleagues there, set up a study to investigate meningococcal meningitis in college students. And so we went around to colleges, and we did a case control study, and we found students who'd had meningitis and students who didn't have meningitis, and we went and we asked them a series of questions for risk factors for meningitis. And we eventually found that it was a risk to go to be in college, that your rates are higher for meningococcal disease, and they're in part due to the fact that you're coming into dormitories, living in dormitories was a higher risk, and there were a variety of other things, but one can imagine with lots and lots of people coming in from all over the country and maybe even the world into a new setting, and maybe sharing glasses or bottles at times or other things when you're in college, that can spread meningitis and meningococcal disease. And actually from that study, we published that study and we went and presented it in many meetings, and it started a whole debate about vaccinating kids before they go to college. And that, using that data that we had nationally, we took that data, we used it, and we turned it into something that resulted in vaccinating. And now there's a recommendation for kids when they go off to college to get vaccinated with a four-valent vaccine to protect them from getting meningitis. And so that, to me, is an example of using your scientific skills, looking at data, and applying it into the real world and potentially having an impact. I mean, we'll never know what the impact truly is of that, but it probably is saving lives around the country. So that's an example of sort of public health practice and what medical epidemiologists do.
We're getting close to the hour. One more question. So it sounds like you're really excited about going to work every day.
I am, yeah.
So what does your typical day look like?
Well, yeah, I guess my typical day is I come in, I'm the head of an epidemiology group, and so we're working, as the epidemiology group, we are responsible for doing surveillance for invasive diseases around the state of Alaska, and we have many, many different studies going on within the state of Alaska and some even in other places. So my day typically is coming in, touching base with my team, working with my team to troubleshoot and problem shoot issues on studies that are being done, also looking at and going to meetings to review our surveillance data to see what we're seeing, to see if there are new and different trends that we're picking up. And then also taking the work that we do in science and trying to turn it into a product that will get out to the public and have an impact. So we do this science and we learn from the science, And then we try to take that science and put it into a format that can get out to the public, so the public knows, or can return to a community where we did the study to let them know what we found. But also, we put it into scientific language and publish it in the scientific literature. So other scientists who are thinking about doing the same sort of studies or thinking about research in that way can read it, can look at it, can do their own tests of our hypotheses and see if they get the same results.
So how many publications have you been involved with, would you say?
I would say probably 110 or 115, something like that.
Wow, that's impressive. And with that, we can just run right into our program. So you all know the bio of Dr. Bruce, and if anybody wants to see more about that, we do have it on our website. And so, please, microphone is over to you.
All right. Well, I wanted to first thank everyone for coming today to the beautiful Beartooth Theater to hear a talk about zombies in the Arctic. Now, I know that most of you have probably been to an Arctic zombie talk before, and I'm going to do my best to keep this one interesting. I don't want to give you the standard Arctic zombie talk that you all have heard. But before I dive into zombies, I wanted to thank the World Affairs Council and President Lisa Falsko for inviting me to speak. This is the second time I've spoken to the World Affairs Council. The first time was a few years ago on Ebola, when a friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Tim Thomas, and I spoke after returning from West Africa to deployments to two different countries during into the hot zone. Some of you, I spoke to the students earlier, but for those who weren't here, I'll just let you know that I work for CDC. I work for the field station here in Anchorage. I've been working there for the past 18 years, and I am a medical epidemiologist, and I'm focused on infectious diseases. So I just want to have a hand of from folks of who here knows what a medical epidemiologist is, or yeah, okay, there's one person. Oh, okay, the students know because I was telling them about it, so that's pretty good. Okay, actually, that's better than I thought. Because I'll just tell you, when I did an internal medicine residency, when I finished my residency, we got together with the residency director to tell people and the director what we were doing after residency. And they went around the room, and it was cardiology, gastroenterology, nephrology, and they got to me, and I said, epidemiology. And they all looked at me, and the people around me said, what is that? So no one really understood what I was doing. And I have to say that when I'm at parties and someone asks me my profession, and I say medical epidemiologist, I've been asked if I can look at their skin. No, I'm not a dermatologist. It's not dermatology. But my favorite was, I told someone I was a medical epidemiologist, and they said, oh, you work with the weather. And I looked at them and I said, not exactly, but pretty close, and they weren't close at all. So it's not well understood, but as I was telling the students, basically, medical epidemiologists are public health docs that apply their clinical knowledge to solve public health problems on a population level. And I do that as an infectious disease epidemiologist. Some of the other things that we do in the group that I work with is we share responsibilities with the state of Alaska for doing surveillance for a whole variety of infectious diseases around the state to track those infectious diseases. We also do scientific studies to help us better understand public health problems. And one thing I love about our group is what we do, everything we do is linked to some sort of public health action. We are not doing research for the sake of research. What we do needs to have an action component to improve people's health. Another quick question, show of hands. How many people here know what Centers for Disease Control or CDC is? Okay, wow, that's good. All right, that makes me happy. Okay, now how many people knew that the CDC had an Arctic field station in Anchorage? Wow, that's pretty good. That's way more than I thought, because I was going to say, if it makes you feel any better, you know, there are about 12,000 employees at CDC. Most are based in Atlanta, and a lot of them don't know about the Arctic Field Station at CDC. We're kind of a well-kept secret. So our mission at AIP, where I work, Arctic Investigations Program, is to promote health in the Arctic with a focus on infectious disease. So it's really a broad mandate. And that has allowed me to not only work in Alaska, but to work across many, many different countries in the Arctic. And so today I'm going to try to talk to you and tell you some stories about some of those investigations done that we did in the Arctic. So now, moving on to zombies. When we think about zombies in the Arctic, what do you guys think of? Well, yeah, so I've just put up a slide of an amalgamation of different zombie pictures, and these are sort of the scary zombie skeleton brain-eating zombies. And I have to admit, I couldn't resist, I had to put a raccoon zombie up. Now, I don't know if any of you have heard, but a week ago, there were reports out of Ohio in the news of a raccoon zombie outbreak. Raccoons were standing up on their hind legs and walking around with a blank stare on their faces and then falling over and appearing dead. And then they'd get back up and they'd get back up on their hind legs and they'd walk around like this. And it was all over the news. So I had to throw in a raccoon zombie. As it turns out, it was distemper. But it sure was raccoon zombie-like. So I have good news for all of you Alaskans out there. Alaska appears to be the best place for a zombie apocalypse. So this is from an internet news article titled, "When the Zombie Apocalypse Hits, Pray You're in Alaska." So it goes into and tells that Alaska is the best place to be for a zombie apocalypse, and apparently New Jersey is the worst place to be for a zombie apocalypse. But New Jersey might be the worst place to be for other things too, but I won't get into that. So just another great reason to live in Alaska. But you're probably wondering why Alaska would be such a great place if there were a zombie apocalypse. Well, this is an article, let's see how it came out, okay. This is an article from KTUU titled, "Alaska Has What It Takes to Survive a Zombie Attack." And I love the explanations for why Alaska is a great place to be if there's a zombie apocalypse. It's like a David Letterman countdown list. I need Paul Schaefer to be, you know, hitting the drums right now. So I'm going to go into the top four reasons why Alaska would be such a good place if there were a zombie apocalypse. You probably can't read it on the slide. Reason number one, Alaska has the fewest people per square mile in the United States. So there are fewer zombies to chase us. So that's great. Reason number two, we have the second highest gun ownership per capita in the United States. We have lots of guns to shoot the zombies with. That's pretty good too. This one's my favorite. Now, reason number three, it's from the National Funeral Directors Association. Of all the states, Alaska ranks number 13 for cremation. We cremate a lot, so there won't be zombies to chase us. And then number four, we're very physically active here in Alaska. We're the number seven in the nation for physical activity, so we are going to be able to outrun those zombies because we're in good shape. Because I don't know about you, but I want to be on foot when a zombie is chasing me. I think I'd rather be in a car, but anyway, we're in good shape and we can outrun them. So I love these reasons, but it makes you feel good about being an Alaskan during an apocalypse. But seriously, folks, you know, can the zombie apocalypse happen here in Alaska? Well, it depends on how you define a zombie apocalypse. If your definition is like slide number one with brain-eating corpses, then probably not. We probably won't. But if it's something caused by this organism that I'm going to show you right now, one of the most dangerous probably on Earth, then yeah, it probably could be. And this is a picture of the influenza virus. And I think if zombies can be called the walking dead, influenza viruses really could probably be called the floating dead. Because they're not really alive. I mean, viruses are amazing organisms. But flu viruses are basically RNA packets floating through the air, waiting for you to inhale them when someone coughs or sneezes your way who has the flu. The virus then binds to your human cells and begins replicating. So I'm going to go into a story about the 1918 Spanish flu, the pandemic, and talk about the critical role that Arctic countries played in improving our ability to fight this disease in the future. But before I do that, I just want to do a quick lesson on influenza. So we're going to nerd out here a little bit. So this is a slide that tells you that influenza is a single-stranded RNA virus. It has spikes protruding from its surface, which are surface proteins, and they're called hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. Hemagglutinin allows the virus to attach on to your cells and to enter your cells. Neuraminidase allows the virus to break out of your cells and spread through your body. And yes, there will be a quiz at the end of this. But seriously, I'm telling you this because flu viruses are named for their surface proteins. You've probably all heard of things on the radio. They talk about H1N1 and they talk about H3N2 viruses. Those are the two strains that are circulating in this most recent flu season. And H stands for hemagglutinin and N stands for neuraminidase. Another little information on influenza. Influenza viruses have evolved over probably a very long time, and they've evolved predominantly in the intestines of birds. So birds are their main reservoir. However, flu viruses can mutate, and they have the ability to jump to other non-bird species, including mammals and humans, and they do that. So every year, flu spreads around the world, and there are two flu seasons, one in the northern hemisphere, one in the southern hemisphere. And every year, just in the regular flu season, we have about 5 million severe illnesses with the flu and about 500,000 deaths. That's every year from the regular flu. So just think about those numbers, 5 million cases and 500,000 deaths. I mean, if that isn't a great reason to get vaccinated for flu every year, I don't know what is. And really, this is my one public health plug in the talk, really, if you're over 6 months of age, you really should be getting the flu vaccine every year, unless you have contraindications against it. It may save your life, or it may save the life of someone around you. And I know that sometimes we don't have a great match between the circulating strain and the vaccine, but the vaccine does protect you at a certain level. I think this season it's somewhere around 38% protection. And then it can give you protection for the next season if those components that were in it are floating around in the next season. So it is quite valuable. Anyway, but about three times a century, the world experiences a flu pandemic. And a flu pandemic is different from the regular seasonal flu. It's when the flu virus changes dramatically, and we call it antigenic shift. The proteins on the surface of it change dramatically in a way that the population has never seen it before. It's a new foreign thing introduced into the system. So essentially, everyone who gets exposed to it gets infected. You have no antibodies to protect yourself against it. And that's what happened in the 1918 pandemic flu. So it's not known exactly where the 1918 pandemic flu started, but in that year we were engaged in World War I, and at that time there were massive troop movements across the Atlantic, back and forth across the Atlantic, and around the world. And these really contributed very heavily to the spread of flu globally at that time. Some other facts about this flu: more U.S. soldiers died of pandemic flu than were killed in action in World War I. That's how bad it was. 40% of the Navy was affected by the flu, and almost 40% of the Army was affected. This flu was so bad that U.S. life expectancy dropped by 12 years in 1918. We've never seen anything like that before, and we hope never to see it again. So this is a picture of some pictures from that time in 1918 when the pandemic hit. And worldwide for this pandemic, we estimate that 200 to 500 million people were infected. That was one-third of the Earth's population at the time. Think about that. And there were between 20 and 50 million deaths. That was a true zombie apocalypse. Also, remember at this time there were no drugs to treat the flu like we have now, and there was no vaccine. In the US, we had somewhere around 10 to 20 million cases and about 675,000 deaths. And in a normal flu year, it's really usually the elderly and the very young who are hit hard by the flu. In the pandemic flu of 1918, it hit the elderly, it hit the young, but it was really very deadly in young, healthy people. Very, very unusual for flu. Very few places in the world were spared this flu. This flu made it into so many remote places. It was remarkable. It made it onto the island of Svalbard. I don't know how many of you know the island of Svalbard. It is far, far north in the Arctic, extremely isolated. There was a mining colony on Svalbard at the time. The flu virus hit and it killed many, many miners. Unfortunately, it also hit remote villages in Alaska. And one of those villages was the village of Brevig Mission up in Norton Sound. When the flu virus hit Brevig Mission, it killed 90% of the villagers over a period of 5 days in November 1918. The bodies were buried in a grave and frozen in the permafrost where they lay over time. This is a picture of the Brevig Mission gravesite that I'm showing you. And this is a picture of a memorial cross with an inscription on it about those who died. And from this unspeakable tragedy comes a story of Alaska and Alaska Native people in particular making a contribution to science and our knowledge of this virus that could possibly save lives in the future. So the story goes, in 1951, a researcher in California named Johan Hultén really thought that the key to understanding this most terrible of all infectious diseases that had ever hit the earth was to isolate the virus, to be able to actually have the virus. So he heard about Brevig Mission, he contacted the elders and the tribal council there and got permission. He went up 50 years ago and they exhumed bodies, they took tissue, he took it back to California to his lab, and he tried, and he could not isolate the virus, unfortunately. But he was very persistent. 50 years later, in the early 2000s, he had the same idea again. And he contacted the tribal elders, he went to the village, I think he was in his 80s or 90s, I mean, this is a really persistent scientist. They went back up there, they took lung tissue from some of these bodies, from people who had died. And this time he sent the samples to Jeff Taubenberger's lab, who then worked with the CDC and the US military that had some samples from a soldier that died in World War I. And they, for the first time in history, were able to reconstruct this most deadly of viruses and look at its DNA. So with this reconstruction in hand, they were able to determine why it turned so deadly and learn a tremendous amount about this virus. And that's the story of the Spanish flu. But there are many different types of viruses floating out there, of flu viruses floating out there, and they can mutate. Some are very dangerous, sitting in the animal populations, just waiting to mutate and wreak havoc worldwide, just like the Spanish flu did in 1918. And one of those viruses that really scared us about a decade ago was H5N1. I don't know if any of you remember there was some hysteria over H5N1. And H5N1 flu had spread across three continents. It had spread across Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. It was infecting people who had contact with birds. It hadn't mutated to go human to human. It was only bird to human transmission, but there was a lot of worry about this virus. 60% of people who caught this virus died, 6 in 10. So this is a map showing in red the countries most affected by H1N1. I think this is about in 2010. So in China, there were 38 cases, 25 of them died. In Indonesia, there were 165 cases, 136 of them died. This was a really scary flu that we did not want to move any further than it was. But as it turns out, some of the wild bird species in Asia were infected with H5N1. Remember from our early nerdy lesson that flu viruses evolved in bird intestines. So it was infecting birds in Asia, and guess where those birds migrate in the spring? They migrate all the way up to Alaska and to other countries in the Arctic. So, zombies on the way. So this is a map of the global migratory routes for wild birds around the world. And it's a little bit hard to read, but it shows you that there are migratory routes that go through Asia and up into Alaska and other parts of the Arctic. And it was about this time that my group at CDC was contacted by some of our partners who were concerned about exposures of rural Alaskans to H5N1 flu viruses from birds coming in from Asia. And in particular, they were really interested in subsistence hunters hunting birds and thought that they were potentially at risk. So at that time, our partners came to us and asked us a number of questions. And some of those questions were, are Alaskans being exposed to H5N1? Have rural subsistence hunters been exposed to this deadly virus? And is exposure common or is it uncommon? And are people who are handling wild birds taking precautions when they have contact with them? So we designed a study to look at sports hunters, subsistence hunters and their families, because family members are oftentimes cleaning the birds, opening them up, and wildlife biologists to determine, one, exposures to H5N1 virus, and we did that by drawing blood on them and looking at antibodies, and then risk factors for exposure, and we did that by asking a questionnaire. And we enrolled over 900 participants in this study. And what did we find? Well, we found that all three groups, sports hunters, subsistence hunters, wildlife biologists, they had a lot of exposure to birds that migrate to Alaska who are potentially infected with H5N1. And the average cumulative exposure to birds was about 10 years. The main risk factor we discovered was lack of hand washing. Over half of the hunters didn't wash their hands during or after handling wild birds. And finally, none of the participants had antibody to H5N1. Despite high levels of exposure to birds and lack of hand washing. So this was really good news, and we kind of breathed a sigh of relief. So the main messages that came out from this study were that there were no exposures to H5N1 virus, that persons needed to wash their hands during and after hunting and after cleaning wild birds. We also recommended that wild birds be cooked thoroughly before consuming. So the H5N1 flu zombies haven't made it up here to Alaska yet. So, I guess, how do we combat the zombie apocalypse of influenza or other infections that move north to the Arctic? Well, you have to be prepared for things and be on the lookout for them. If you're not looking for it, you're not gonna find it. So look for it, or it's gonna find you. One of the things we do where I work is we look for it. We do surveillance for infectious diseases. And our field station in Anchorage is the headquarters for a surveillance network that spans across the Arctic. And actually, the founder of this network is sitting here in the room today, and his name is Dr. Alan Parkinson. Alan, could you raise your hand? He's the one who started the whole thing, so yeah. So we track infectious diseases across the Arctic to allow us to detect outbreaks, to monitor the impact and effectiveness of vaccine programs, and to detect emerging pathogens. And these are the countries shown in blue that are currently participating in our bacterial disease surveillance. So I'm now going to tell you a story of what I think is an interesting emerging pathogen in the Arctic that we discovered using this ICS, or International Circumpolar Surveillance Program. And that is Haemophilus influenza A. And it's called Haemophilus influenza, but it's a bacteria. It's not influenza. It's what we thought caused influenza before we knew about the influenza virus. So we're gonna talk about HIA. But the story really starts with something called HIB, or Haemophilus influenza type B. And we had some of the highest rates of Haemophilus influenza type B in the world here in Alaska, particularly in our indigenous populations prior to vaccine. And it was a really devastating disease in young children, causing meningitis. It was just awful. And then a vaccine was introduced in the early 90s, and it was amazing. HIB cases decreased dramatically, and we don't see much HIB anymore. It was a true public health success story. However, about 10 years later, through our ICS system, we picked up a new emerging Haemophilus influenza called serotype A. And Haemophilus influenza serotype A, we're going to nerd out a little bit more here. It's a gram-negative bacteria that lives in your throat, at times, and if conditions are right, it can travel from your throat and get into your bloodstream and become invasive and cause very serious disease like pneumonia and meningitis. So this Haemophilus influenza A is really quite a devastating disease in children less than two. In Alaska, 25% of cases in our study that we looked at either died or had long-term damage from the disease, and 1 in 10 cases died. So this disease really is a zombie apocalypse for young children in the Arctic, in Alaska and Northern Canada. And it was through our ICS system that we picked up these cases and in Alaska and Northern Canada that now have the dubious distinction of having the highest rates of invasive HIA disease in the world are in Alaska and Northern Canada now, unfortunately. So we've worked very closely with our Canadian partners on this HIA issue, kept the other partners in the network informed, and happily, I can say that the Canadians have recently developed a vaccine for HIA that they've tested in animals, and they're now working to develop a human vaccine against this deadly disease. And so in the future, we hope that there will be a human vaccine, so there is some hope in sight for this disease. And that's the end of the HIA story.
This is KSKA Anchorage. You are listening to Addressing Alaskans. Today's show is called Can the Zombie Apocalypse Happen in the Arctic? And Other Tales of Arctic Infectious Diseases. We're featuring Michael Bruce, who is a public health physician and medical epidemiologist trained in internal and preventative medicine. Let's go back to him on the stage at the Beartooth Theater.
And now I'm going to go ahead and move right on to what I consider a really interesting bacteria that's quite prevalent in many populations across the Arctic. And when first discovered, no one believed the scientists who discovered it. So who here in the audience has heard, just give me a show of hands, has heard of Helicobacter pylori? It's a mouthful. Yeah, okay. There are some. That's actually more than I thought. Again, this is an educated audience. It's not well known. But I'll say to you, I have to admit that if someone came to me and said that there was a life form that lived in the vacuum of space, I wouldn't believe them. If someone came to me and said there was a life form that lived in flowing lava, I wouldn't believe them. And if someone came to me and said there was a life form that can live in hydrochloric acid, I wouldn't believe them either. Well, I'll let you in on a little secret. Helicobacter pylori does not live in outer space. It doesn't live in lava, but does live in the stomach, which is filled with hydrochloric acid. It's an incredible feat and an ingenious adaptation to live in an environment where nothing else can survive. Now that's zombie-like to me. It's so improbable that anything could live in the stomach that when doctors Warren and Marshall discovered Helicobacter in 1982 out of the stomach, no one believed them. Even scientists didn't believe them, and they had a lot of difficulties in those early years. But over time, the scientific community realized the errors of their ways and that the work that Warren and Marshall did was very valuable, and they ultimately ended up winning the Nobel Prize for their work. This is a picture of Helicobacter pylori. It looks sort of like a space creature to me. It's helical shape with flagella. If you saw it in real time, it would be spinning like a corkscrew and propelling itself forward through the vacuum of space. Okay, I was just seeing who's paying attention. We've already established it doesn't live in space, it doesn't live in lava, but it does live in the stomach, and it propels itself through the stomach mucus, attaches onto the stomach cells, and then creates a buffered environment around it where it can live for decades or for the rest of your life. Once it gets in you. So most people who are infected with Helicobacter pylori actually don't go on to develop disease. Only a small portion of the people infected will go on to develop ulcer disease. We know it's the main cause of ulcers now, and also they can develop gastric cancer. So how do people get this infection? Well, it's transmitted fecal-oral or oral-oral, and basically that means via poop or vomit. Prevalence tends to be higher in populations living without piped water or flush toilets. We now know that Helicobacter pylori is quite prevalent across the Arctic, with high prevalence in specific populations living in remote communities in Alaska, in northern Canada, in Greenland, and in northern Russia. And up to 75 to 90% of inhabitants are infected with this bacteria. I mean, a lot. So we have a lot of people in remote communities infected with this bacteria. And from studies that we've done across the Arctic, we know that these same populations are infected with Helicobacter strains that have resistance to antibiotics. So it turns out it's actually not so easy to grow Helicobacter and do this sort of testing to determine if it's resistant to antibiotics, but we can do that here at our shop at CDC in Anchorage, and we do that. And actually, we have the only surveillance system testing for antimicrobial resistance for Helicobacter in the world here. And so we work with four different regions in the state of Alaska. They send us samples in, we grow it up, we test it, and we feed that information back to them so that they can give it to their clinicians, so that their clinicians can know what are the appropriate antibiotics to use to treat their infections in their region. We also work very closely with many of the Arctic countries on issues related to Helicobacter. We have high prevalence populations in the high north, and in the lower latitudes, it's low prevalence. So when you compare Alaska to the lower 48, the northern Canadian territories to their provinces, or Greenland to Denmark, there are great differences in what we call the epidemiology of Helicobacter across those two by latitude. And that makes a big difference in how you diagnose and treat Helicobacter. So we've worked with our circumpolar, our Arctic colleagues, and we've come up with some guidance for how to diagnose and treat, and we've gotten that information out to our circumpolar and Arctic partners, and we think that's been useful. The other thing we're working on with Helicobacter is trying to develop a way to identify which are the good and which are the bad Helicobacter. So, you know, if you're infected, most people are infected with Helicobacter, they don't have any problem their whole life. But some Helicobacters are worse than others and can have pathogenicity factors that can make it more likely to cause gastric cancer. What are those factors? We're trying to do some studies so that if you come into the doctor, they test you and say, you have Helicobacter pylori infection, they can say, you have Helicobacter pylori infection with the bad Helicobacter, and we need to treat you immediately and follow up closely. My last story is a story about zombie infections in the permafrost. And let's see, yeah. So this is actually a cover from a story done in the Atlantic magazine just 5 months ago titled The Zombie Diseases of Climate Change. So from scientific studies that have been done around the world, we know that the Arctic is warming, and it's warming at about twice the rate of the rest of the planet. So the cold has really been a protective barrier for us, and for us Arctic residents in regards to infectious diseases. And now that extreme cold protective barrier is disappearing. If we're on the theme of zombies, it's almost like we've had a protective force field around us in the Arctic, protecting us from those temperate and tropical diseases from coming in. That force field is waning and will disappear into the future. So we're really going to have to be smart about how we deal with this, with infectious diseases in the coming years. But if you had asked me just 5 years ago if infectious diseases could come out of the permafrost and cause illness, I think I would have laughed. And then this story came out about 2 years ago. I don't know if any of you saw this. But this was a story done by NPR titled Anthrax Outbreak in Russia, Thought to be a Result of Thawing Permafrost. And on the Yamal Peninsula in northern Siberia 2 years ago, a 12-year-old boy died of anthrax. 100 people were hospitalized with suspect anthrax. Thousands of reindeer died. And then many, many reindeer were slaughtered and culled because of this. And they eventually vaccinated over 800,000 reindeer with an anthrax vaccine to try to protect the herds. So how did this all happen? Well, basically, anthrax spores lay dormant in the permafrost, just waiting for their zombie apocalypse moment. So you have to understand, the Yamal Peninsula is very far north. It is very cold. in that region. It's up around the same latitude as the North Slope and even higher in some places. The permafrost in that area of Siberia can go down 1,000 feet. But during that summer of 2016, there was a heat wave, and that heat wave got up into the 90s. So what that did with the warmer surface temperatures, it caused a melting of the top layers of the permafrost. We know that reindeer have been herded across the Arctic for hundreds and perhaps thousands of years, and we also know there have been massive die-offs of reindeer from anthrax over that period of time. Probably at least 1 million reindeer over a period of the last century or two have died from anthrax. When they die, they then get buried into the permafrost and frozen into the permafrost. So really what happened is reindeer herders in the Yamal Peninsula were grazing their reindeer over reindeer that had died of anthrax decades or centuries ago, and they then contracted anthrax because of this and were exposed to it because it had melted out of the permafrost. So this is a BBC article titled, "There Are Diseases Hidden in the Ice and They're Waking Up." In it, they describe current research on bacteria and viruses in the permafrost and the ice. And in 2005, NASA scientists revived bacteria that had been frozen in an Alaska pond for 32,000 years. I thought that was a really long time until in 2007, scientists found an 8-million-year-old bacteria that lay deep under a glacier in Antarctica. In 2014, they isolated viruses out of 30,000-year-old permafrost layers in Siberia. So, yes, zombie-like organisms like anthrax can come out of the permafrost and get us, but is there a risk of other organisms? Do we have to worry about smallpox? Do we have to worry about plague? Are these things going to be coming out of the permafrost, you know, and getting us? Well, I guess it's theoretically possible, but anthrax is a very, very resistant organism once it gets into the environment, more so than many other bacteria. So it's going to depend a lot on how resistant those organisms are in the environment. But we do have to be vigilant, especially with what's happened with anthrax and the permafrost. So just to wind up, I know we're running out of time. This is my Arctic zombie summary. So zombie-like organisms from the past can get us by melting out of the permafrost that we've seen through it with anthrax. Zombie-like organisms can get us from the air, cough or sneeze. We've seen examples of influenza and Haemophilus influenza A. They can get us from spreading person to person and survive the acid of the stomach to live comfortably within us for the rest of our lives and possibly cause disease, Helicobacter pylori. And then zombie-like organisms can also spread to us from contact with animals, such as birds with H5N1 and many, many other organisms. So this is my last slide. And I think Louis Pasteur was right when he said, it's the microbes that will have the last word. Or is it, it's the zombies that will have the last word? Thank you very much.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We're hearing from Michael Bruce, the epidemiology team leader at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Arctic Investigations Program in Anchorage. His presentation was titled, "Can the Zombie Apocalypse Happen in the Arctic?" and Other Tales of Arctic Infectious Diseases. We return to the stage at Beartooth Theater to hear Dr. Bruce answering questions from the audience.
All right, so there's one issue within the topic of zombies that I'd like to explore a little bit more, and that is the issue of post-mortem animation. As your first slide indicated, post-mortem animation in TVs and movies and stuff is horribly unrealistic, right? And full of all sorts of contradictions.
Yes.
They're dead, but they still need to eat. They suffer from rigor mortis, but they're still out of motor control. So based on your experience and your knowledge of real-world organisms like parasites, I'm wondering if you could construct for us a realistic zombie that has post-mortem animation, such as able to walk around, attack humans, and make zombie noises.
That's a challenging one. I think my analogy to zombies was more the ability of infectious diseases to come in and wreak havoc on populations and the planet, not so much reviving dead bodies to come back to life. There are certain things that can put you in a state of kind of torpor where it looks like you're dead and you could come back. But I was thinking of it more in terms of sort of the disasters, the apocalypse, the zombie-like things that infectious diseases can do. And I can't think of an infection off the top of my head that would bring a body or appear to bring a body back to life, but it's a good one to think about. Thank you.
Hello, my name's Dennis. I'm a registered nurse, and in my 30-year career, I've had the occasion to take care of two patients with foodborne botulism.
Yeah.
So my question today is, what's the current status of foodborne botulism in the Arctic?
Yeah, it's a great question. And actually, I had many, many different stories I wanted to tell, and I just only had so much time. So botulism is a great one. Botulism, in a sense, is sort of an Arctic infectious disease. If you think of Arctic infectious diseases as diseases that have really high prevalence in the Arctic. And when you compare rates of botulism in the Arctic to lower latitude rates, or you compare, say, Alaska to the lower 48 states, our rates are hundreds of times higher than what you see there. And so botulism still is a problem here in the Arctic. I mean, botulism, most botulism outbreaks, for those of you who don't know, botulism is caused by Clostridium botulinum. It's a bacteria, and it can live in the soils and the dirt. And if the conditions are right, basically anaerobic conditions, it can grow under anaerobic conditions, and it can produce a toxin that is the most potent, most deadly toxin known on the earth. A pint glass, this much botulinum toxin would kill every living human being on earth. That's how potent botulism toxin is. And we have higher rates of it in the Arctic, in part due to some food practices that we have. Now, people ferment food all over the world. It's almost like a universal cultural thing. So that's not unusual. But one of the things that we discovered that was a really interesting story with botulism, I'll try to make this quick, I know, is that we had a bump in botulism rates a number of years ago, and we investigated and we found that it was in part due to a change in practice. Fermenting foods and fermenting fish heads and seal flippers is kind of a tradition among some of the indigenous people in Alaska and across the Arctic in northern Canada and Greenland, and it's a delicacy. And they would do that in skin bags or in wicker baskets and bury it in the earth. It would be under cooler conditions. If the temperature is a little higher, if it goes completely anaerobic, it's more dangerous. They switch from that to sealing them up in those plastic sealed tubs, basically. And that made it completely anaerobic. And then we had sort of more botulism outbreaks. So we worked to try to do an education campaign and work with the communities and really emphasize, and I think it was successful, emphasize traditional cultural practices. The traditional ways were actually quite a bit better than this new way of doing it. And we saw a decrease in botulism rates. We do still see botulism cases occur here in the Arctic, and we do have high rates still across the Arctic countries. It's not something we do surveillance for, but it's a great question. It's a really interesting one, especially for the Arctic. So thanks for asking that.
One of the historically most devastating diseases in Alaska has been tuberculosis.
Absolutely.
Which has receded greatly now. But what are the chances that this disease could come back and get us?
Right. That's a great question. We had terrible problems with tuberculosis epidemics in the past here in Alaska and across the Arctic. And right now, if we look at tuberculosis sort of on a national basis across the United States, usually Alaska is duking it out with Hawaii for the number one ranking of most tuberculosis in the United States. So sometimes we're number one, sometimes we're number two. So we still have the highest rates of tuberculosis in the United States. When you look across the Arctic at tuberculosis, the rates of tuberculosis in parts of northern Canada and Greenland are a whole factor higher than what we have here in Alaska, despite the fact that we have the highest rates in the U.S. The rates in Greenland and northern Canada are even, 10 times what our rates are. So a whole other factor higher. So tuberculosis still is an issue in the Arctic, and in part because of that, we have worked to create a network for surveillance for tuberculosis across the Arctic, and to form a research working group, a circumpolar working group, with representation across the Arctic to work on tuberculosis issues across the country, so we can bring our minds together and learn from each other. So hopefully that answers your question.
With the emerging bacteria and viruses from the permafrost and ice, do you know if they, as they are, do they pose a threat to the human immune system, or if there's a likely chance that they'd mutate to do so?
I think that's a great question. Thanks. If anthrax is any example, then yes, they could be a threat. I guess what really is probably the most important thing, Bacillus anthracis can go into a sporulated form and form sort of, it's almost like it forms a crust around itself to protect itself from the environment, and it can sit dormant for a very, very long time. A lot of bacteria can't do that. And so I think for example, if you had someone who died from smallpox, and they were frozen into the permafrost 150 years ago, and they thawed out of the permafrost, I guess to me the question would be, could the smallpox virus survive intact? You may have pieces of DNA, but you'd have to have the virus surviving intact to be infectious and be able to cause a problem. And so that's kind of the big question, I think, is whether those bacteria and viruses survive intact. And certainly the research is showing that there are bacteria and there are viruses that survive intact, but we're pretty new in that research, and most of the ones that are don't appear to be pathogens for human beings. Now, one intriguing thought is this goes back into prehistory. So what happened before history was recorded? Did we have massive die-offs from an infectious disease that we've never seen, that's sitting in the Arctic that we've never experienced? That's sort of an intriguing thought too, kind of a nightmare, zombie apocalyptic thought, but let's hope not. Anyway, thanks for the question.
Hi, I'm a medical coder, and I'm really interested in viruses and that. What do you think about the manipulation of the rabies virus? They talk about that into a rage virus that could become airborne. Using the flu virus. Have you heard anything about that? Or I've been doing some reading up on that.
I am not familiar with any research on aerosolizing rabies virus. Yeah, and what is the purpose of that? Is this for
biological warfare?
Yeah, biological weapon. I'm not familiar with that, but that would be very, very dangerous because rabies is a essentially universally fatal infection. If you get rabies and you're not treated immediately, you will die from rabies. It's a really bad one. And rabies, it's an interesting virus. If you get, the closer you're bitten to your neck, to your brain, the more rapidly it potentially can progress to your brain and the less time you have. So there have been stories of rabies where people get bit on their foot. They don't know that they've been bitten by a rabid bat or a rabid skunk or whatever, and it travels very, very slowly up the nerves of the body and eventually gets to the brain even years later and causes rabies. So rabies is a very interesting but universally fatal disease that you would not want to weaponize in any way if you have any sanity. Yeah, but thank you. Yeah.
Speaking of the zombie apocalypse, I had two follow-up questions to the first question that you had. The first one being, have you heard of the fungus that affects ants in...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the one that actually...
Right, right.
Zombifies
That's a great example. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And do you think that could ever be tracked back to humans through the food chain somehow?
Probably not. Yeah, there is a fungus that can infect ants. I think it even grows out of their heads, and it will change the behavior of ants. I can't remember exactly what it does to their behavior, but that's a great example of that happening in the animal world. Now, the chance of that fungus being able to, even if you say, ate an ant that had the fungus growing out of its head, it's highly unlikely that fungus would cause a similar thing in human beings just because ant physiology is so different, and the ants and the fungus have probably been fighting it out over the millennia or over millions of years, and that's an ant-fungus thing. But it's a great example of, and there are other examples that I just can't think of off the top of my head, but that's a really, really good one. Maybe you have another.
Yeah, yeah. My second question is about mad cow disease and about how that could possibly, because there was that huge scare that people thought that the beef from cows with mad cow disease would cause humans to start wanting to eat flesh. So I wonder if you know anything about that, because you might not, but that was my question.
Could you repeat that second question? Because I thought of another, I thought of another organism. There's a recent story, I'm sorry, we'll get back to mad cow, but there's a recent story on slugs that became infected with an organism that will eventually eat the slugs, and what it does to the slug brain is it makes the slugs go towards these organisms and makes it easier for the organisms to get into the slugs and eat them. And slugs will avoid these organisms in the wild. They've evolved to know that these things are bad for them, but if the thing gets into a slug, the slug goes towards it and leads its other slugs to it. Anyway, so there are things that can sort of, yeah, and anyway. So could you repeat the mad cow question again?
Yeah, yeah. So, there was a scare back, I don't know, I think it was like the 60s or something, where there was an outbreak of mad cow disease, and the newspaper thought that the beef from the cows with the mad cow disease would cause humans to want to eat flesh and zombify them.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's an example. Actually, I have a third example of possible zombie. And that's with bath salts, but that's a different... That's a different example. So,
I'm going to feature you to talk about bath salts next week.
Yeah, the mad cow disease. I'm not familiar with any humans eating beef that was contaminated with mad cow and then wanting to go on and eat flesh and turn into zombies. But it's a great story and it's a great thought. I mean, mad cow disease and kuru. There's a whole series of these infections that are really quite interesting. It's a whole different organism. They're not viruses, they're not bacteria, they're not fungus, they're prions. And what prions will do is they will change the conformation of the proteins in your body. So when you get exposed to it, if it goes to your brain, which is what happens in mad cow and kuru disease, it'll get into your brain, it'll change the configuration of the proteins in your brain, and it can cause a lot of damage. So it's a whole nother thing to worry about out there with prion disease. But anyway, I could talk about that for a long time, but thanks for the question, yeah.
With the continued warming of the higher latitudes, are there particular diseases that CDC is concerned about migrating out of their more traditional warmer homes, I suppose?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yes, and I think we're starting to work in this field quite a bit. I think you're absolutely right that we know that this warming trend is probably going to continue. And I think some of the things that we need to do is, one, we need to sort of set a baseline. We need to know, of the infectious diseases that we have here right now, basically, where are they at? I didn't have a chance to go into this at all during my talk, but most of the infectious diseases we know of are called zoonotic infections. They are infections that are in animals that will get transmitted to us. They'll get transmitted to us through contact with the animal, or more indirectly through an insect, say. That's considered a vector-borne transmission. You have rats that have the plague. Fleas bite them, and the fleas jump on us and transmit the plague to us. So 60% of infectious diseases are zoonotic. They're in animals. And so with climate change and probable warming, we are going to have dramatic changes in our animal populations. We're going to have dramatic changes in our environment, fauna and flora, and we're going to have changes in diseases that can come to us from the animal populations. So one is to set a baseline, and we've actually started to do that. One of the studies we've done is to look at 11 different infections like you're talking about that we worry about, and to go and do seroprevalence studies around the state to figure out who has antibodies to these infections, who's been exposed to these infections, where are we at with that, so that in 10 years' time, we could go and draw blood from them again and look and see and say, aha, back in 2018, only 10% of people were exposed to this, and now in 2028, we see that it's 25%. So we know this is moving in, but we need to do the same thing in animal populations too. And we need to also sort of do the same thing in the environment, and this is now called the field of One Health, looking at human health, looking at animal health, and looking at the environment also. Because sometimes I feel like as humans, we don't think of ourselves as living in the natural environments, but we really are, and we live with other animals, and we live in, you know, nature is all around us, so we really do need to look at all of these components in order to prepare for this. So I don't know if that answers your question exactly, but to set a baseline, to get more education out there to the public as to what's going on and what needs to be done, and also to be wary and thinking about what the new and different infections that could potentially come up from the lower 48, and to start thinking about surveillance mechanisms for them. But it's very difficult, because we don't have a crystal ball. No one knows what those are going to be, but we have to take our best educated guess. It's like when we develop the influenza vaccines. We have to develop them about 6 months before the flu season. So we have a worldwide network to look at what flus are happening all over the world, and we make our best educated guess from the flu viruses that are occurring all over the planet. We say we need to put this one in, and we need to put this one in, and we have to do it about 6 months ahead of time, so that by the time the vaccine comes out, they may have mutated, but we have to make our best educated guess, and that's what we do. Hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question about superbugs. So I was just wondering, how much of a threat do you think superbugs sort of pose to humans in general?
Yeah, the superbugs are very, very scary. And I assume what you mean by a superbug is a bug that has multiple resistance to antibiotics. So we have more and more of a problem with these superbugs that are not just resistant to one antibiotic or two antibiotics or three antibiotics, but are resistant to all antibiotics. And we're starting to see more and more of this, and there is a lot of work now being done to try to figure out, one, how to deal with this, two, work with industry to develop new antibiotics and drugs to counter this, and then also how to prevent transmission once we encounter these new things, so that these new superbugs, so that if someone with a superbug comes into a hospital, that they're not transmitting it all around into those areas. So those are the things we're working on right now, I think. And yes, superbugs are scary. We are now, for the first time in history, encountering people who come in with infections, and we can't treat them. there's really nothing we can do. So I think we need to be very vigilant about our antibiotic use. We've been using antibiotics in animal populations to increase their weight for more meat production. We get exposed to that at times. We're using antibiotics in the human population sometimes inappropriately. We've made some major advances in that over the decades. But there is a lot more that we can do.
And we have time for one more question.
Briefly?
Pardon me?
Briefly.
Oh.
Warming vector-borne ticks. What do we have?
Yeah, I'm not a tick specialist, so I'm much more of a generalist, but I would tell you that we are seeing ticks in Alaska. We do have ticks in Alaska. And some of the tick populations will do better with a warming climate. Some of the tick populations that, if they were introduced here, that would die out in very, very cold winters. If the climate becomes milder and winters are not so cold, we won't see the same die-offs with the ticks, and they may be able to spread more. And then we have actually seen ticks coming up from the lower 48 that we haven't had here before on dogs, when dogs get brought up, or if different animals get brought up. Ticks can live on birds. They can live on migratory birds. So migratory birds coming in from all over the world can bring in ticks too. So we are seeing more ticks, and there are more studies being done now in Alaska to try to look at those tick populations and do what I think they call them tick drags. So they'll take these sheets of cloth and they'll move through an environment, and ticks will grab onto to things and then, you know, try to bite you and suck your blood, and they'll do these tick drags through the environment, and they're doing tick drags and looking at changes in tick populations over time by doing that. So there is more tick research being done, and in particular, we're worried about certain tick species that can harbor infectious diseases, and not all tick species can. So hopefully that answers your question to some degree. Yeah, we can talk later, too, if you'd like.
Thank you so much. We're going to have one more round of applause for Dr. Mike Bruce.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've just heard from Michael Bruce, who is a public health physician and medical epidemiologist and the epidemiology team leader at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Arctic Investigations Program here in Anchorage, Alaska. This event was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council on April 13th. I'm your host and producer for Addressing Alaskans, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage. Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.